he's in denial. Jeremy has a background in science, majoring in biology at Sydney University. He's been writing about the human condition since 1975, and in 1983 he established the Foundation for Humanities Adulthood, of which he's currently director. He's published two previous novels, Free, The End of the Human Condition, and Beyond the Human Condition. And tonight we have Timothy McCartney-Snape speaking with Jeremy. Timothy was the first Australian to ascend Mount Everest. So please welcome them.
Thank you, and good evening. Thank you for coming along, giving up your time on this balmy, really balmy, Sydney Friday evening. And I'd like to thank Lee Books for having us here. I'm obviously best known for being a climber. And Everest has been in the news a bit lately due to its 50th anniversary of its first ascent. It's a good question to ask, why is it the massive ice and, well, fairly crumbling rock can hold such a powerful grip on the human imagination? I'd like to suggest it's because the mountain is, Everest, is the ultimate physical symbol of the uniquely human need to explore and assert ourselves. Certainly for me, it marked a culmination of an urge which I've had ever since I can remember. A dominant part of my makeup has been one which compels me to have a look around the corner. It's a longing to know what's over the horizon, to wonder at what might be glimpsed from the top of that mountain over there. It's always been a question of exploration for me to climb. But what is it that drives one to climb where no one else has been, under impossibly taxing and frightening situations? Firstly, for me, it's been the curiosity about what lies ahead. And this is always underpinned by the hope that somewhere above I'll find a path that will lead me to the summit, or at least a comfortable bivvy where I can spend the night. The other is the thrill and self-affirmation that comes with succeeding against difficult odds. And to put it bluntly and plainly, it delivers plain old ego satisfaction to get up a mountain. Inevitably, when one climbs a mountain like Everest, you get asked the question, what next? But of course, I could reply, there are plenty of other mountains to climb, ones that are lower but more difficult, etc., etc. But you cannot escape the feeling that to keep striving on that physical plane is to stagnate. To find yourself, after all the risk and toil and privation, in the same place. You know, the ultimate summit is perhaps just a dream, a figment of one's imagination. Any climber with any imagination knows that the key to success in climbing is to master not this physical hurdle, which you tend to do anyway, but the psychological hurdle. Because if you master the psychological difficulty of the climb, then overcoming the physical hurdle will follow as surely as day follows night. And if you think a bit more about it, a bit deeper, a bit more profoundly, you come to the realisation that climbing is really just a physical manifestation of an underlying psychological journey in need, which began, I suggest, way back in our species' childhood, when we started to exercise our curiosity and ventured out from the golden savannah that was our cradle in the Great Rift Valley of Africa. You'll notice that in The Species in Denial, the book we're promoting today, that there's a liberal use of quotes from Socrates onwards. They're not just any old eloquent quote, but they're bits of expression which resonate with the deeper aspects of what it means to be human. And this is because the book engages with the subject of human nature very thoroughly. And despite the general denial of our true nature or condition, writers and poets have in a great many instances alluded to or touched on those deeper truths. that we so artfully and with good reason until now evade. I'm going to start the ball rolling, pretty devastating, let's say, with the great Scottish psychiatrist Arding Lang, or Lege if you follow the dictionary pronunciation, who wrote, "We respect the voyager, the explorer, the climber, the spaceman. It makes far more sense to me as a valid project, indeed as a desperately, urgently required project for our time, to explore the inner space and time of our consciousness. Perhaps this is one of the few things that still makes sense in our historical context. We are so out of touch with this realm. The condition of alienation, of being asleep, of being unconscious, of being out of one's mind, is the condition of the normal man or woman. And between it and our soul, there is a veil which is more like 50 feet of solid concrete. Deus absconditus, or we've absconded. Insanity is a perfectly natural adjustment to an insane world." Can he have been serious? Well, I think he was. The notion that our world is not as we consciously perceive it to be is a deeply unsettling one, of course. And it's reasonable enough that we should expect ourselves to be conservative in the acceptance of new ideas, especially those which threaten our perception of reality. But I can do no better than use another quote, this time from Laurens van der Post, who is a true prophet of the 20th century, who, like Jeremy, has been held up to ridicule for his deeply penetrating and prophetic pronouncements. And he wrote, talking about Freud, "One could perhaps better have measured the originality of Freud's achievements by reason of the numbers of the highly intelligent, well-informed men who instantly mobilised to attack him. Their resistance was evident and understandable. The world of appearances in which they had their self-importance and which their minds and imaginations had served as the only permanent and worthwhile dimension of reality was suddenly shown up to be merely one aspect of reality, and a rather shallow one at that." Van der Post makes it clear in there that he considers reality to be composed of several aspects, and that the plane of reality occupied by the educated is not necessarily of deep profundity. And indeed, throughout the history of ideas, the common theme has been that whenever a major clarification of the human situation has been put forward, early advocates have been ridiculed and persecuted. Historian Richard Tarnas summarised the resistance that has met each major change to humans' worldview thus: as if to consecrate the birth of a fundamental new cultural vision, in each case a symbolically resonant trial of martyrdom of some sort was suffered by its central prophet. Thus, the trial and execution of Socrates at the birth of the classical Greek mind, the trial and crucifixion of Jesus at the birth of Christianity, and the trial and condemnation of Galileo at the birth of modern science. 19th century philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer also commented on the historical journey of ideas, and in summary he made this point: the reception of any successful scientific hypothesis goes through predictable phases before being accepted. First, it is ridiculed and violently opposed. Second, after support begins to accumulate, it is stated that it may be true, but it's not particularly relevant. And third, after it's clearly influenced the field it's talking about, is it admitted to be true and relevant, but the same critics assert that the idea is not original. Finally, it's accepted as being self-evident. As I mentioned, the purpose today is to introduce Australian biologist Jeremy Griffith's new book, A Species in Denial, which was launched in Sydney a couple of weeks ago. This book deals head-on with that most controversial realm of inquiry where science and religion finally overlap, the issue of our very nature, the human condition. It was this arena that poet Gerard Manley Hopkins was referring to when he wrote, "Oh, the mind hath mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful sheer, no man fathomed." They are indeed many crevasses and precipices to be negotiated by those who first venture into the mountains of the mind. Despite the great difficulties of venturing into this realm, it's vital to our species' future to do so. In the late 1980s, I, along with Jeremy and some others, got together to promote the Foundation for Humanity's Outlook and thus promote the inquiry into the human condition. And given the extremely contentious nature of this realm of inquiry, it's vital that any debate about it is fair. It's also vital that any who come to appreciate that real progress has actually been made in this area by these ideas be steadfast in their support, not intimidated by any unfairness or misrepresentation. For as John Stuart Mill pointed out, the dictum that truth is always triumphs over persecution is one of those pleasant falsehoods which men repeat after one another till they pass into commonplaces, but which all experience refutes. History teems with instances of truth put down by persecution. If not suppressed forever, it may be thrown back for centuries. Although the public presentation of the ideas underpinning the species in denial is still in its infancy, a measure of its paradigm-shifting magnitude can be gauged from the severity of the campaign that was waged against the Foundation, the FHA, in the mid-1990s. A campaign that has ended in the FHA being forced to take legal action against the two largest media organisations in Australia, the ABC and the Sydney Morning Herald. A couple of weeks ago in Sydney, a Supreme Court jury found that an ABC Four Corners program defamed both myself and Jeremy. And I find it astonishing that we had to resort to taking defamation action against the ABC to get redress, when in 1998 the Australian Broadcasting Authority found the Four Corners program was inaccurate, unbalanced and partial in what was its strongest ruling ever brought down against the ABC at that time. It even recommended the ABC apologise, and it still hasn't done that. No matter what he's thought of currently, Freud was a giant in the history of ideas, and the demystification of our species is what he was involved in. And because he was the first to work with the concept of the subconscious mind, he suffered for bringing that subject up initially. But before Freud, there was Darwin and Alfred Wallace, who had taken what was for their time an even larger step in the demystification of the human situation with their idea of natural selection. How do people like that come up with such momentous ideas? Almost universally, it is seldom through what they've been taught, but what their own free-thinking minds have come up with, have absorbed and then synthesised into new insights. If the origin of species, which Darwin was finally forced to publish, didn't actually want to do that, because he thought it was going to create a big enough stir, he wanted to publish posthumously, but Wallace forced his hand. If his book was an unusual but immensely important book as time had come, I say that A Species in Denial is an even more unusual and an even more important book whose time has come. And I say that with deep conviction. It's highly improbable that an idea this penetrating, this paradigm shifting, could come out of the ivory towers of mainstream thinking, for it's another common theme in the history of ideas that radical new ideas tend to come from outsiders. And this was pointed out by Thomas Kuhn, who observed that revolutions are often initiated by an outsider, someone not locked into the current model, which hampers vision almost as much as blinkers would. The need for an unblinkered view is most crucial of all when it comes to this issue of the human condition. An insight into the human condition has to come from the periphery, where a natural mind, coming into being secure in its place, can think freely without the blinkers of the sophisticated cultural world. And my mind turns to A.D. Hope's poem, Australia, the last two verses of which say much more succinctly than I ever could. Yet there are some like me turn gladly home from the lush jungle of modern thought to find the Arabian desert of the human mind, hoping if still from the deserts the prophets come. Such savage and scarlet as no green hills dare, springs in that waste some spirit which escapes the learned doubt, the chatter of cultured apes, which is called civilization over there. The human condition is the underlying issue in all human affairs. In his introduction to his book, Jeremy describes the human condition as the elephant in our living rooms that no one acknowledges is there, because our necessary denial of it has become so habitual as to be almost over the horizon of consciousness. Not only is that elephant there, but we are collectively 2 million years habituated to denying its existence. This denial of the human condition permeates every aspect of the human situation. Even science is tainted by it. To quote physicist Paul Davies, for 300 years science has been dominated by extremely mechanistic thinking. I have little doubt that much of the alienation and demoralisation that people feel stems from the bleak sterility of mechanistic thought. It has undoubtedly had a stifling effect on the human spirit. And Charles Birch, who was Jeremy's zoology professor at Sydney University, who wrote the foreword to Species Denial, has written, or has said, science can't deal with subjectivity. What we were all taught in universities is pretty much a dead end. For two of our leading scientists in Australia to make such statements ought to be a matter of great concern to us all. As Jeremy will summarise shortly, there are very good reasons for humanity's historic denial of this issue of the human condition. And what becomes clear is that only when science could explain the mechanisms of life could we safely bring to an end that denial, and by so doing, bring about a meaningful future for us all. I've known Jeremy for about 15 years. He's the most fair-dinkum person I know, and the kindest person you're ever likely to meet. He's also the most devastatingly honest person you are ever likely to meet. He's so honest, in fact, that he has made honesty about that most difficult of subjects safe at last. Those cliffs of fall, frightful sheer, now level out to fecund foothills of plenty and plains of liberation. It's immensely rewarding to be involved in this pioneering expedition, and although I'm still stuck in the old habit of physically climbing mountains, I suppose I will be for as long as I'm able, this new vista before us as a species is grander than any view you can get from the mountain. Of course, there are difficulties in coming to terms with the issues dealt with in this hitherto forbidden realm. It was never going to be easy kicking a 2 million year habit, but collectively we must go there, and soon. I invite you to give it your best try and hope you'll be able to help engage your friends and Australia in debating this new paradigm. Thanks very much, and I ask you to welcome Jeremy.